Joining me on the Neil Wilkins podcast in this episode is the founder of the Urban Farm podcast and a whole lot more, Mr. Greg Peterson. Welcome, Greg.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me.
And it really is a whole lot more, isn't it? Because the podcast is one of those things. It is the voice of a lot of what you do. But the things that are going on behind the scenes for you, you are prolific, aren't you, in terms of creating an urban farm?
Yeah. So I actually live in a rural part of North Carolina now, but I lived in Phoenix, Arizona for 55 years. And in 1989, I purchased what became the Urban Farm. The Urban Farm is a standard size lot in Phoenix, Arizona, 80 feet by 160 feet, about a third of an acre. And so it's not very big at all. And I had 80 fruit trees on the property and what's called an edible landscape or an old growth food forest, where over the course of the 30 years, I would plant things and they would go to seed every year and reseed themselves and, you know, make plants the next year. And in a big part, what I was doing in Phoenix on the urban farm was just growing, letting nature be and growing food and then harvesting. So my job became harvest food. It's kind of like, you know, happens in nature, but it was happening in my yard.
Now, I know Phoenix, I know Scottsdale and the sort of surrounding area, and I know that that isn't necessarily the first place somebody might think of if they're thinking of the kind of work that you're doing, because there are much more lush areas of this planet. There are much more, I guess you could sort of say, naturally productive areas when it comes to fruit trees, farming and the like. So. Yeah. Phoenix, I mean, it's a low desert. It's pretty hot during the summer. It's pretty hot during the winter. This is not the natural place that somebody would naturally kind of think of for this sort of thing.
Yes, and there's 4.7 million people in Phoenix, Arizona that have to eat. And the environmental and health cost of growing food in New Zealand or South America or 1,500 miles away and shipping it is dramatic. I'll use that word. And so really my message is, even if you're just growing herbs in a windowsill, by the way, herbs are the most expensive thing to buy in the grocery store and the easiest thing to grow. So grow your own herbs and it can be that simple. So really what I'm encouraging people to do wherever you live is grow a little something. And yep, Phoenix is hot. Phoenix is really hot and there's not a lot of water there. And I was able to achieve a really nice edible landscape over time in the low desert. And the other side of that coin is that there is a textbook size book called Edible Plants of the Sonoran Desert. That's the desert we live in there. And there are literally hundreds and hundreds of things that grow in the desert that you can harvest and eat. So even in the desert, you can get a food forest. If you're going to, you know, if you want to grow just desert things, you can make a desert food forest.
I love this phrase that you're using here. You've used it already a couple of times, this edible landscape. That it just feels delicious even before we start. I mean, there's just something about that. Landscape, yes, implies beauty, it implies nature. But the edible bit, that's fascinating, that combination of the two. I don't think naturally people would expect those two things to kind of coexist. But this feels like it is at the core of what you're doing.
It is. I have always been of the opinion, if you're going to plant something and nurture it and make it grow, make it edible or make it supporting edible. And what I mean by that is if you have a nice ash tree in your backyard in the desert and it's losing its leaves in the winter, don't rake up the leaves and throw them away wherever away is. Those are nutrients in those leaves. Use those leaves for leaf mold compost. By the way, it's one of the best composts out there. And so really it's a process of thinking through what you like to eat, because I always suggest that people plant only what they love to eat. And than figuring it out. And there's this term, I call it the P word. It's called permaculture. It's a word that was created by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren back in the 1970s. And it's a combination of permanent and culture, or permanent and agriculture. And it basically looks at how nature works and mimics nature. I'm a big proponent that nature always bats last. Nature is always going to win. We're not going to be able to outdo nature. So we need to start paying attention to nature. And nature does a particular kind of system that is very different than human-created systems. Nature creates a regenerative system, a system that recreates itself over and over and over again. It's a circular system like that. And humans came along and they wanted to make systems from nature their own, but every single system I have ever found in the human condition, and I have been looking for decades, is what we call degenerative. And degenerative systems fail over time. The screen in back of me, the computer I'm working on, the chair I'm sitting in, the chair you're sitting in, the microphones we're talking about, the cars, the roads, the everything requires attention periodically to make sure that it keeps moving forward. And it will eventually stop. You know, our car will eventually run out. This computer, my car is good for me for 30 years. My computer, if I get 5, 6, 7 years out of the computer, I'm feeling lucky. So we've baked into our human culture a degenerative set of systems that will all end. And I have known this since the 1970s. I wrote a paper in 1974 in the eighth grade on how we were overfishing the oceans. And it just made sense to me back when I was 15 years old, and I have no idea where this came from, but it made sense to me that we cannot continue fishing the oceans the way that we've been fishing the oceans and have them, and I use this word lightly, have them be sustainable. And the reason I use the word lightly is because sustainable simply sustains the mess that we've created for ourselves. Regenerative designs systems that recreate themselves. And I don't know if human beings can actually successfully create regenerative systems. So it becomes a process of making systems that are more regenerative rather than less regenerative. And that's really what I teach. And in 1991, I did a seminar at Landmark Education, and it was about building a vision for your life. Now, this was 33 years ago, and I created for myself that I am the person on the planet responsible for transforming our global food system. And here we are 33 years later, and that's what I do. And back to your first comment about my podcast, that is what the podcast is about. The podcast is about sharing people's stories of successes and failures in the realm of food and what they did with it. I had a guy, this was so cool recently, he reached out to me and wanted to be on my podcast. And I said, well, tell me. And he shared with me that he'd been listening to my podcast for a while, and he started gardening and then farming out of listening to the podcast. And then his garden went from a 10 by 10 to a 50 by 100 foot area. That's huge. And then all of a sudden he had way too much food. And then what did we do with it? And so he ended up going to the farmer's market and getting a booth at the farmer's market and having a great time doing that. And all because he listened to what I share. So that's really the impetus behind the Urban Farm Podcast. And what I, everything I do is really sharing how easy it is to grow your own food and why we should do it.
There's something here that I'm kind of picking up, which is, it just feels so right. And I kind of try and explain kind of what I'm feeling as you're describing this, because it feels that this is so, so different to the person who maybe buys a new property. They're looking at their backyard, they cover it in AstroTurf rather than having a lawn. They concrete the drive rather than letting things become natural. They're manicuring, they're almost fighting against the natural laws here. And actually what they could do is actually embrace the this edible landscape. I love that. But you know, they could just really embrace that kind of, as you say, it's there's cycles going on here. There's a natural way. Mm-hmm. There's an ecosystem that we could tap into. And yet, and I see so many examples of this, and probably over time, you know, I've fallen into this trap too, of this kind of human ego that we can control nature and expect a good outcome. It feels that this is really driving in the face of that and saying, hold on, guys, we are just merely human. We're the ones who need to tap into this bigger thing than us. Am I kind of reading and sensing this right?
Absolutely. Have you heard my quote? Because you just spoke exactly to what I wrote. In 1996, I wrote this quote, "Our downfall as a species is that we're arrogant enough to think we can control Mother Nature and stupid enough to think it's our job."
Oh, I mean, that's far more eloquently put than the way I described it. But
you were going down the same
page.
Road.
I'm totally on that page. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's exciting. And so, and what we do in permaculture is we look at the systems that are in place. I've told people this for years, and then I had to come here to Asheville, North Carolina, and live it. But what I tell people is spend at least a year on a property before you make any major changes. And then I land, and I spoke that for the past 30 years, having lived on the same property for 30 years. And, you know, and then I moved to Asheville, North Carolina, and I have 4 acres. And if we would have put the greenhouse in the first year we got here, it would have been in the wrong place. Chicken coop would have been in the wrong place. The gardens would have been in the wrong place. And what this points to is the basic premise of permaculture, and that is observe. Spend time in your space, paying attention to what's going on in the space. Look to see where the water goes when it rains. In Phoenix, Arizona, we get 7 inches of rain a year. We've already had 11 inches of rain here in Asheville, North Carolina this year. We'll hit 40 inches for the year. Here. Excuse me. So that's just something to pay attention to. Where does the water flow? We do a water harvesting summit every summer and look at water harvesting and how much you have and what can you do with it and how do you direct it. And in the low desert, that's drylands. That's a very different water harvesting climate than, it, you know, 40 inches a year. So I'm learning new things about harvesting water here in Asheville. And where does the wind blow from? What's the prevailing wind? And do you have, oh, here's one. I planted 160 fruit trees and berry bushes last summer. And in one of my orchards, which is off to the right, I planted out 6 apples and peach trees on a Saturday. And I went out there on Tuesday, and these were nice sized trees, and all the leaves were missing. All the leaves got eaten off. Deer. Well, I have a deer path through there. So I had to, you know, make an adjustment for figuring that out. So, you know, rather than fighting it, we put a system in place that basically what I did is I liquefied some cayenne pepper and I sprayed it on the trees, and the deer leave them alone. Cayenne pepper is natural and the deer don't like the hot pepper taste. And the interesting thing about that was that once they learned, they left the trees alone Now, I only had to spray cayenne pepper on them twice. And for the rest of the summer, lay off the trees alone. It's like, oh, okay, those aren't good to eat.
This feels so, like it's something so much bigger, I'm going to say, than just farming or just gardening or just permaculture. There's something in the work that you're doing here, which is a reminder to us all to slow it down mm-hmm. and actually and observe. Because, you know, without that observation, you could have so easily with the deer, you could so easily have thought, well, it's the wrong position. It's, you know, it's they're the wrong trees. I made a bad purchase of, you know, the base tree or whatever. But just stopping, pausing, listening, observing, and actively then responding to it. It feels like this could play out in all forms of life. It's not just production of food, is it?
Exactly. And so permaculture for me is a lifestyle. It's the way that I live. And let me give you an example here. In permaculture, we have something called stacking functions. One of the principles in permaculture is stacking functions. And it'll sound real familiar when I explain it. Basically, in permaculture, you have one asset. Let's call it an apple tree. And rather than just harvesting apples off of it, that's one of the assets that we get from it. There's other things that the apple tree offers us. It offers us shade. It offers us leaves for mulch. Same thing for a chicken. You know, chickens in our landscape. I'm a big proponent of having three or four hens in your backyard if you have a backyard. And hens in our backyard, they give us eggs. They eat bugs. They eat weeds. They do great digging. They make great friends if you're into that. So those two assets are things that do more than one thing. And if you look at nature, pretty much everything does more than one thing. So that's what we call stacking functions. Now, I went back to college late in life in 2001, and I was in a transportation planning class. And so I have an undergraduate and an advanced degree in urban and environmental planning. That's city planning, essentially. So I was in this transportation class with this professor, and he started talking about trip stacking. And this is just something people, I would guess, normally do. You don't go to the grocery store and then come home, and then go to the pet store and then come home, and then go to the doctor and come home. If you're going to drive away from your house, you're going to go to the pet store, the drug store, the grocery store, the doctor, and kind of, right? Trip stacking. So how can you look at the different things that you do in your life and have them serve multiple purposes? That is a permaculture concept that can be overlaid on everything. So my podcast, let's talk about my podcast. First of all, I love interviewing people. It's one of the most fun things that I do. Secondly, I like learning from them. One of the big reasons that I do my podcast is to learn new things. It's one of my ways that I learn long term. Third thing it does is it fulfills my I'm a person on the planet responsible for transforming our global food system. Right? I get to meet new cool people like you, you know, and have fun, great conversations. It's just so my podcast serves multiple purposes. It's called stacking functions. So, permaculture can be overlaid on really any part of your life.
It's such a great philosophy, isn't it? I think, you know, once people start thinking this way, it's irresistible, isn't it, really? Because it just makes so much sense. If you're a really practical, logical person, there's a lovely efficiency within there. If you're more of an intuitive person, you can make those links that kind of to some of us are a little bit esoteric and a little bit out there. But to somebody who's very, very intuitive, it's like, well, yeah, obviously I can link this and this and this. And then there's a lot of storytelling that goes on behind that. Yeah. This is something that, as I can totally understand when you say it becomes a lifestyle. It's just all pervasive. It's just everywhere, isn't it? I mean, when you start, something like this. I mean, let's kind of return back to the. To the backyard or the little plot of land that somebody might have, and they're thinking, okay, this sounds great, sounds like a really good idea, but I have no clue where to begin. Is it the most obvious starting point, which I need to rake some soil here to actually create a platform or the foundations to kind of build something from? Is that kind of where you start?
Well, that's one way to start, but I would, drum roll please, stand back and observe. See what's going to work in your life. Observe your life. What's going to work for you in your life? If you don't have much time at all, putting in a 10 by 20 garden in your backyard is probably going to be problematic. But if you like to eat fresh herbs, plant some basil in the windowsill and go that route. And there's so many things in between. Remember my friend with the 50 by 100 garden? That's pretty extreme. He's retired and that's what he does full time. And there's herbs in the windowsill and a zillion things in between. So really, I would suggest that people look at their life and see what's going to work. I lived in for a short period of time, I lived in a townhome with a 10 by 10 backyard. And one of the things we had in the backyard was a tower garden. A tower garden is a hydroponic growing system. And it stands about 6 feet tall. And there's a 20-gallon bucket of puddle of water at the bottom with nutrients in it. And once an hour, the pump starts up and it splashes the water all the way to the top of the Christmas tree. And it trickles the water down through the tube and plants grow out of the side of it. So that's one possibility. There's, just get some pots in your back and front yard on your front porch. We used to grow a fair amount of food on our front porch in Phoenix, Arizona, in pots. So you really have to ascertain what's going to be easiest for you to manage from a day-to-day basis. And I always suggest people start off simple. My friend we talked about earlier with a 50 by 100, he started with a 10 by 10 and grew it from there. On my podcast, I ask a question in my signature question section, and I say, tell me about a time you failed and what you learned from it. And that question is based in a time that I failed and what I learned from it. And what I did in 2004 was I started a new business, a gardening business, and we were growing plant starts, the little 4-inch basils and lettuces and that kind of stuff, right? And I jumped in with the prompting of my business partner, and rather than growing 1,000 to start, or 5,000 to start, or 10,000 to start, or 20,000 to start. We started with 80,000 plant starts the first year. And it turned into a massive failure. And part of it had to do with weather that year. In January, the plants were looking great, but they weren't saleable yet. In February, it rained every weekend. In February that year, and our plant sales were way, way down. And so I couldn't sell them. So I ended up giving away 50,000 plant starts. I just put an email out on my email list and said, hey, come and get them. You make a donation, they're yours. And that taught me to start small. And the thing is, I've been self-employed since I was 15. I'm coming up on 50 years of owning my own business. Businesses, I've had many of them. And you would have thought in 2004, let's see, 84, 94, 04, after 30 years of running my own businesses, that I would have gotten a clue about not starting big, that I should have started small. And, you know, those are the lessons we learn. And so really that's the reason that I really push people to stand back and observe and start small. Start small, do a little bit so you can be successful, because, you know, I'm not getting out of this business anytime soon. So that failure wasn't one that could get me out of the business and out of the education. But yeah, there you go.
It's kind of the sort of thing that with a lot of enthusiasm, I mean, clearly, I mean, just the way you describe that, we'll call it a failure, but it's just a journey, isn't it?
Exactly.
But kind of where you were at that point, I mean, you have to be applauded for the enthusiasm and, you know, the excitement of so many plants. I mean, that's just off the scale for most of us, just even visualizing how much that would look, you know, in terms of if that was all laid out in front of you.
One of the fun parts of that is we actually used the roof of my house to store plants. And I have photographs standing on my roof with 5,000 plants on the roof of my house. So,
got to put them somewhere, I guess.
Just exactly. Put them exactly. Yeah, wow. We had fun with it. It was great fun.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because you kind of, if you looked at this from a commercial sort of business perspective, if you're able to scale, why wouldn't you? And yet the reality of something like permaculture and this kind of longer term commitment is patience seems to be everything in this. Mm-hmm. So even if you're starting with, you know, a little pot on the front porch, or, you know, a small plot, because that's the size of plot you have as a backyard, it feels that there has to be some level of patience here, and that even if you see this as replacing some of the weekly food shopping bill, or you see this as a, you know, if you're going into retirement or something, you see this as a longer term sort of pastime that is going to turn into something really valuable. Mm-hmm. The level of patience, because you're talking seasonal, working with nature, yep, you cannot, as a human, change that, really, can you? Well, I guess you could put up a greenhouse or two or three, and you could try to adapt the temperatures and this, that, and the other, but ultimately the nature's going to win, isn't it? We have to work with nature's timescale, don't we?
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong, even in permaculture, there's nothing wrong with scaling up. But with my, you know, with my 80,000 plant starts, there was no scaling up there. I just went for it. And you know, a better plan would have been grow 8,000 plant starts the first year. And because when people fail, generally they fail and then, oh, it's like, all right, well, I shouldn't be doing that. And that's where I really want people to get that. Yeah, you're going to make mistakes, but make them small, start small and grow from there.
Yeah, and I think that's such a sound piece of advice, because with something like this, the unpredictability, especially for the novice or complete beginner listening to this and thinking, yeah, I want to give this a go, you're going to fail so many more times. You know, more things are going to die than succeed is my kind of prediction. But is that not right? Is it actually easier than it sounds?
Absolutely. And I tell people this all the time. I promise you, I've killed more plants than you have. And anybody out there listening, but not on purpose. You know, you do something and you figure it out. That's how we learn. The first time I grew broccoli, I bought some, and this was 40 years ago, I bought some broccoli seeds and I stuck them in the ground and was like, oh, that's what broccoli looks like when it grows. I even had a person at one of my tours one day look at broccoli and they said, oh, we thought broccoli grew underground. You know, so this is how we learn, and there's no stupid questions, you know, and jump in and ask away and make mistakes. You are going to make mistakes, and that's okay, and learn from them and do it differently next time.
And this feels like it's something that, yes, you can give it a go alone, but to have something like Urban Farm Podcast and your blog and your, you know, all the various kind of resources and assets that you offer, Greg, I mean, it just feels that you're kind of within a safe community where you can learn together. That feels as that's quite an important element of permaculture. You can go it alone, but actually the community element of it feels quite important.
Exactly. Exactly. I am a huge proponent of doing what's called a permaculture design course. It's they're offered globally. If you're interested in learning about permaculture, type in the name of your town or city near you and type in permaculture design course. And people do them online. But my challenge with them online is that you're not in a group of people, not physically in a group of people. And I am a huge proponent of doing a permaculture design course in a group of people, in person, and getting that community interaction, because there's so much value in it.
It does feel this kind of, it's really an embracement of, is that such a word, or it's an embracing of
both, I like that.
Both the human and the nature. It kind of feels like they kind of cohabit, but also it's important that, yes, if you're very introverted, or yes, if you like doing solo projects, it's kind of okay to do that, but that you're going to get so much more if you realize, both as a human, but also in nature, you're actually part of a bigger ecosystem. So this is a really collaborative approach, isn't it? And I'm guessing sort of within communities, there is sharing of, you know, the starter plants, there's sharing of kind of the tips and advice, and you can kind of succeed and fail together, and that's kind of okay.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I manage a Facebook group here in Asheville called West Asheville Garden. And the other 2 weeks ago, so we talk a lot about permaculture on the Facebook page. And 2 weeks ago, somebody posted on there that she wanted to do a seed and plant exchange. And before long, 30 other people had jumped in, and they have one scheduled for a week from Saturday. You know, just building in community, and what happens at a seed and plant exchange is people brings what they have extra. Because here's the thing I've noticed decades ago. There's only one place on the planet that lack lives. It's right between our ears. Because when I look at the massive abundance that comes out of fruit trees or carrot seeds or, you know, your garden, it's mind-blowing. The amount of abundance is there that we need to work in partnership with. I'll say that.
And there's, I guess, a lot of people struggling financially, you know, across the globe with the current kind of economic climate is challenging, to say the least, I think, for a lot of people. And yet there's an answer here, isn't there, that is not only great for your health because you're growing it yourself, but actually it's that psychological health that's coming through here clearly in terms of, you know, that engagement and the passion with which, you know, you can share this stuff. But also then there's a financial benefit, because if it is as abundant as you say, you're going to have more carrots than you can actually eat, aren't you?
Right. Absolutely. Must have been about 20 years ago. I was watching a morning news show, Today Show, here in the States. And they were doing a segment on this family that lived in a 1,000-square-foot house in Arkansas or someplace like that. I don't remember exactly where they were at. And there were three generations living in the house in 1,000 square feet. So there was, I don't know, 6 or 8 people in the house. And they were really struggling with their food budget and their budget in general. And they showed the house and they showed around the house and like that. And I just shaking my head. It's like, you have all this dirt around your house. Why aren't you growing food? So, and here's something that was magically happened last year. I worm compost. I use worms to compost, and worm compost or worm castings is worm poop. And so all of our kitchen scraps goes into the worm bin, and it gets processed, and it takes about 6 months to get it through the worm bin. And then I take those worm castings, we call it gardener's gold in gardening. It's full of micronutrients, it's full of microorganisms, it's just really great. And I took a handful of worm castings. Remember the 160 fruit trees I said I planted? I took a handful of those worm castings and put them in every one handful in every single hole that I planted a tree. And within 60 days from those worm castings, there were tomato seeds in there. We had 35 or 40 tomato plants growing out in the orchard. Wow. They just magically came up. They call them in gardening, we call those volunteers. They just magically came up. They showed up and we let them grow big because they were kind of shading the trees that we planted. They weren't getting in the way of the trees. And at one point in September and October, we were harvesting 5 pounds of tomatoes a day. 5 pounds of tomatoes a day. And so there's a little street, we're kind of rural here, and there's a little street that runs on the north side of our property. And there's 25 houses down that street. And I had this vision when I moved into the property 2 years ago. It's like, oh, cool. Wouldn't it be fun to have a farm stand in right next to that street and just put up a sign? So what I did is every day I would harvest tomatoes, and we eat mushrooms. So that we get these little cardboard mushroom containers and we saved them all. So we were putting 3 or 4 or 5 pounds of tomatoes on a table next to that road saying free tomatoes from Greg and Heidi's farm. And we made so many friends on the street just from doing that. That's how abundant nature can be. I had one apple tree in my backyard at the urban farm in Phoenix. I would get 300 pounds of apples a year off of that tree. That's a lot of apples. So, you know, just again, flowing with nature, working in the flow of nature, and watching for the abundance that happens in nature is, I believe, is really the solution to our global food system problem.
And it all starts, the power is actually in everybody's hands, isn't it, here?
Yeah.
This is the thing, it's choice. And I think, you know, for a lot of us, we get swept along by a busy day. We get swept along by, oh, I can't, or, you know, this lack attitude, whereas there is this natural resource just begging to have your attention out there, yeah. Isn't there? There really is. And I think it almost feels like we're almost being shamed into feeling guilty about this, because if you're not doing it, you really should be doing it, because there's a multitude of reasons that Greg has given us here. It's irresistible, isn't it? I just can't see the reason why people would not want to do this now.
Yes. And once you eat a fresh peach that falls off in your hand, that explodes in your mouth and makes your toes tingle because it tastes so good. I can't eat store-bought peaches anymore. I can't do it. It just doesn't work for me. And the basis for all of this is healthy soil. The healthier the soil underneath your plants, the better tasting and more nutrient dense the food's going to be. In fact, I've been building gardens here since we got here 2 years ago. And I spend $30 on the garden bed and $300 on soil for that garden bed, because I know that you get what you pay for, especially when it comes to soil. So the healthier the soil is, the healthier the food's going to be, the better it's going to taste. And it's just overall better for you and your yard. And then do it organically, of course.
So is that a one-time activity then, that setting up? Because I'm guessing with the way that you're describing permaculture and your little friendly worms and the process of kind of this recycling and, you know, regeneration in lots mm-hmm. of ways, is it a kind of a one-time investment, then it's done? Or does the soil need kind of topping up?
Great question. Remember, we talked about worm castings a minute ago. If you're adding worm castings every year, or worm compost every year to your garden, will have it thrive. The nice thing is that the big investment on the first set of soil that you put in there, that's all you need to do. And then add a little bit of compost, add a little bit of worm compost, worm castings, add some fertilizers, some organic fertilizers. So in year 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, basically adding an inch of compost on top of your gardens every year or two is pretty much going to do it for you.
And then if you do the math of all of that, the that's an investment, because again, with the abundance that's going to then flow from it, this is not rocket science, is it?
It's at all.
Just simple concept. So why do you feel that more people have not yet got it and embraced it? And it still feels like, not in its infancy, because obviously, as you've described, this has been around for many decades now, mm-hmm. but why have so few people, do you feel, kind of jumped onto this? Because it's just so logically, it makes sense.
Yeah, well, interestingly, the biggest hobby in the United States is bird watching. The second biggest hobby is gardening, which was surprising to me. And so there's a hobby piece of this, the gardening part, that people do because they're called to do it. And those people, that, you know, there'll be a certain amount of people that are called to garden or called to watch birds or called to play the piano. So there's a certain level that'll happen at. And interestingly, the millennial age young people are one of the biggest adopters of gardening in the last few years, which has been real interesting. I think that a lot of people think that growing food is hard. And, you know, we live in a very busy culture. You know, a mom's got three kids and they're in school, and maybe she's working full-time out of the house or part-time out of the house, and the dad's maybe working full-time or part-time out of the house. We live in a very fast-paced culture. And so I think that gets in the way. I have this theory that I developed maybe 20 years ago. I call it my 99-1 theory. 99% of the time people change because they get hit by a Mack truck, metaphorically. 1% of the time they change because they choose. Well, guess what? COVID was a Mack truck. And in a 8-week period in 2020, my team and I did a gardening class a day on weekdays for like 8 weeks. And we just gave them away for free. It's like, you know, come and join us. We had over 20,000 people sign up to our email list during that 8-10 week period. It was amazing to watch. And they were there because they were interested in, growing food, because we were seeing massive food system failures. You know, we'd go into grocery stores and the grocery store shelves would be empty. We saw it over and over again. And, you know, I've seen that when there's a storm here, you know, a big hurricane, the same thing happens. And those are the kinds of things that are propelling people to homestead, to grow their own food, to grow their own healthy food. And I think it's going to take a few more Mack trucks for us to get to where what I saw in Croatia in 2014. I spent 3 weeks in Croatia on a food systems trip with Arizona State University. I used to teach at Arizona State University. And every single house in their front yard had a garden. It was amazing to see. They had a 7-day-a-week farmers market in the town center that was at a permanent location. There were permanent buildings, and they had 150 vendors every day. I did a talk at a community garden that they had started the previous year, and they had 80 slots in the community garden, and those slots were taken up in a matter of days. That's how interested people are in Croatia and growing their own food. And, you know, I think we've seen the beginnings of systems that are failing around our food system, even if it's a trucker's strike or COVID or a big storm that comes through, and people are getting more and more interested. My podcast has been around for 8 years. We have over 800 episodes, and it keeps growing. People are interested. They're wanting to take control of the food that they eat, because there's one piece that we haven't talked about yet, and that's our healthcare system. Especially in the U.S., it's not a healthcare system. It's a put a bandage on it system. And one of the interesting things is that they don't teach doctors in our country about nutrition. And, you know, let your food be your nutrition. You know, that's our doctor. And if we just start eating better, and eating better is a lot of fresh food, hence grow your own, and, you know, not a lot of processed food. So
the math just keeps joining up for me, and it just keeps giving that answer that this is something we all need to kind of look into. And I think you can be doing that little pot on the front porch, or you can be, as we said earlier, you know, getting that big plot of land and really going for it. But wherever you want to start, I want to be pushing people in your direction here, Greg, because the podcast obviously is there. So that's Urban Farm Podcast. Are there resources available?
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of growing healthy soil, as we've discovered a little bit. And there's five components of healthy soil. That's dirt, which you have plenty of likely. There's airspace, water, organic matter, and everything that's alive in the soil. And the nice thing about fixing broken dirt is all you need to do is add organic matter. Add lots and lots and lots of organic matter in the form of compost, planting mix, mulches, that kind of stuff. And so we put together our Healthy Soil Hacked series of videos on, you know, different things you can do to build healthy soil. And you can find that at healthysoilhacked.com.
Brilliant. So I will put that and the podcast link in the description below for everybody to follow up afterwards and subscribe, become part of the community, start to listen, start to sense, watch what happens. If you've just moved into a new place, Greg says, be patient, just wait and see where the water flows, where the deer are, all of that really sage advice. And if anything, just get a little pot and grow some basil or something like that.
Exactly.
To at least kind of get the bug and to get started. Greg, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for all your wise advice. And I feel the need to get out there now and start propagating that soil a little bit further. So I've been dabbling a little with family over the last couple of years. But I'm feeling the urge to get on and do a little bit more now. And I'm sure a lot of other people are. So thank you very much for your time today.
Absolutely. And thank you. I had a blast.